Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Kathy Paikon of the National Kidney Foundation. Thank you. You may begin.
On behalf of the National Kidney Foundation, welcome to Living Well with Immunosuppressive Medications, an interactive telephone forum for recipients, candidates, family, and friends. We chose this topic because you've let us know how important it is. First, our three panelists will speak. We have an exciting lineup today. Deborah Washington, kidney recipient from Maryland, Dr. Shirley Schlesinger, nephrologist from the University of Mississippi, and Dr. Dean Collier, clinical pharmacist from Nebraska. Save your comments and questions because after the presentations, we'll open the microphones for your thoughts and queries. The operator will explain how to do so. With great pleasure, I will now introduce Deborah Washington, a recipient of 10 years. She's a retired LPN from the military, and she volunteers at Walter Reed Medical Center and the Living Donor Assistance Center, the federally funded program that provides lodging and travel grants to potential living donors. Now, anything I mention today not on the topic that you want further information about, I'll provide my contact information at the end of the call. I am also proud to tell you about Deborah's volunteer work with the National Kidney Foundation. She chairs the 7,500-member Transaction Council, composed of recipients, family, friends, many of which you belong to. Transaction is under the NKF's umbrella of people like us and is an organization to encourage, educate, and empower people to be effective advocates for themselves and others. Deborah?
Yes. Good morning. I'd like to begin my presentation by quoting Dr. William J. Kauf, who invented the first dialysis machine in 1943. Quote, "The exciting thing is to see somebody who is doomed to die live and be happy." End of quote. My name is Deborah Washington, and I am a kidney recipient. I was diagnosed with focal segmental glomerulosclerosis in 1986. My condition remained stable for nearly 10 years by following a low-protein, low-sodium diet and a variety of medication regimes. My nephrologist was straightforward in my future need for dialysis and eventual transplant. Hemodialysis became my treatment of choice. This was a very difficult time for me. Although I felt much better after the treatments, the hours, weeks, and months that I spent on the machine were filled with not only concerns about my health, but an array of emotional, financial, family, and personal issues. My options for a living donor were limited. Hypertension runs rampant throughout my entire family, and my dearest friends who wanted to donate were facing personal challenges that excluded them from donation. I came to the realization that in order for me to get off of the machine, someone would have to die. Prior to the surgery, a pharmacist introduced me to a list of medications along with an endless list of possible side effects. She highlighted the problems surrounding immunosuppression and the need to alter my lifestyle post-transplant. A psychiatrist questioned me about my ability to comply with the medication regime. I received my gift from a young man by the name of Kent Bird. He fell down a flight of stairs on Thanksgiving Day, 1997. During a time when his family was preparing to give thanks for all of their blessings, they found themselves in a position to bless someone else. Immediately after the surgery, I was given the assignment to learn and recognize the name, dose, time of administration, and adverse reactions of 8 different medications. Some meds had to be taken on an empty stomach, some with meals, some after meals, some once a day, twice a day, et cetera, and so on. I was also tasked with identifying the signs and symptoms of infection or rejection, monitoring my fluid intake and output, and recognizing when to contact my health care team with concerns. All of this was to be accomplished prior to discharge. In spite of it all, I was happy to be free of the dialysis machine and was willing to do whatever was necessary to remain dialysis free for as long as possible. My thoughts also turned to my donor family and the gift they so unselfishly offered. I began my 6-year quest to contact them and express my appreciation. I hope to speak for the majority of recipients today. In comparison to the physical changes of end-stage renal disease, the emotional roller coaster of dialysis, and the significant change in lifestyle, the side effects of our medications are quite tolerable. Fortunately, most of the unpleasant reactions can be treated successfully by adjusting the medication, changing the medication, or prescribing an additional medication to treat the symptoms. Many of us have been affected by weight gain, insomnia, acne, excessive hair growth in areas where there should be no hair, and loss or thinning of hair where there should be an abundance of it. Gastrointestinal disturbances range from diarrhea to constipation to acid reflux. Vision changes can sometimes be attributed to our age, and females have the advantage of attaching our mood swings to PMS or menopause. Another concern related to long-term steroid use is osteoporosis. Although the diet restrictions are no longer enforced, our cholesterol levels have a tendency to become elevated. We must avoid excessive intake of fatty foods and prepare meals that are loaded with vitamins, fruits, and vegetables. We do realize that some recipients will experience reactions that are severe, such as lymphoma, skin cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. My contact with numerous recipients throughout the United States leads me to feel that these patients are a part of the minority. Men may experience sexual dysfunction. Dr. Schlesinger will discuss this further during her presentation. Unusual signs and symptoms such as low-grade fever and tenderness at the graft site should be reported to the physician immediately. We must closely monitor the color, consistency, and odor of our urine. I personally have had problems with complicated urinary tract infections. Some have required hospitalization and treatment with IV antibiotics, and others have been treated with injections. Continuity of care is critical. Periodically, my physician orders several diagnostic procedures that are designed to detect changes throughout the body. They include, but are not limited to, Pap smear, colorectal screening, a complete dermatology exam, eye exam, bone scan, a review of my immunization status, and a variety of lab work, and of course, urinalysis. Men should also include prostate exams and screening. All recipients with a significant family history should be examined more often. Prophylactic antibiotics should be administered prior to dental procedures. A compromised immune system places us at higher risk for opportunistic infections. We must protect ourselves from others who are ill. Surgical masks are wonderful for the cold and flu season, especially when surrounded by folks who fail to cover when coughing and sneezing. Those of us with small children or pets should be aware that they harbor a large amount of germs. Frequent hand washing and hand sanitizers are excellent for removal of harmful bacteria. Our greatest defense against the adverse reactions is our knowledge of the prescribed medications and the advantage of access to experienced professionals who are dedicated to maintaining the life of the transplanted organ. The ability to recognize changes in bodily functions, changes in our vision, and changes in our skin is imperative for early detection of potential problems. Today's recipients have the advantage of a superhighway of information via the Internet. In addition, the National Kidney Foundation is only a phone call away. With proper health care, consistent behavior regarding the medications, and overall awareness of kidney disease, we should find that the quality of our lives is definitely enhanced after transplantation. I feel comfortable in saying that compared to dialysis, taking a few pills is a pleasure. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Deborah. Now, every recipient is unique, and we're so happy to hear of Deborah's experience and what she has learned and willing to share. And we know that recipients run the gamut of all kinds of experiences, and nothing will take the place of your one-on-one with your own doctor. But this is a great start. With great pleasure now, I'm going to introduce to you Dr. Shirley Schlesinger, a nephrologist who takes care of recipients at the University of Mississippi in Jackson. She's been the medical editor of Transplant Chronicles, a newsletter that NKF puts out that has just gone into an electronic format. And if you don't receive it, I hope you'll email me or contact me at the end of this call so I can sign you up. She has a particular interest in how transplant recipients can manage the side effects of immunosuppression well. And in a few hours, there'll be a slide PowerPoint that kind of gives an overview of what she's going to talk about today placed on the transaction website, www.transplantrecipients.org, that you can refer to. Without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Schlesinger.
Thank you, Kathy. And Deborah, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. I'm going to take a few minutes to expand a little bit on some of the things that Deborah mentioned and try and give you a framework for thinking about the types of side effects that you might be experiencing or might experience in the future when you get a transplant. And then I want to talk a little bit about managing those side effects and the importance especially of sharing all of your issues with your transplant healthcare professionals. I like to think of sort of the side effects or adverse outcomes of your medications in two really sort of very broad categories. One of those could be termed kind of an extension of the therapeutic effect of the anti-rejection medications. You're placed on those medicines specifically for immunosuppression purposes to prevent rejection of your allografts. And unfortunately, prevention of rejection and immunosuppression along with that also immunosuppresses you in other ways. All patients who have transplants are at risk for this extension of the therapeutic effect. These types of side effects tend to be very much dose-related, and as we try to handle these or treat the side effects, we have to consider what we call the net immunosuppression of each individual patient, and that helps us to determine your risk for these kinds of problems and how to manage them. And I'll talk a little bit more about those in a minute. The other type of sort of medication fallout, the other category, is what I would refer to as true side effects of medicines. These are much less predictable. They tend to be different and unique for each individual patient. And yes, although they may be dose-related or timing of medication-related, they aren't always, and so sometimes these types of side effects are somewhat more difficult to manage, although in almost all cases, if you share your issues with your physician, they'll be able to help you with these things. Let's talk first in a little bit more detail about the sort of over-immunosuppression aspects of your medications. There are two big categories of diseases that we deal with there. The first is malignancy, the opportunistic cancer-type problems we see after transplant. Transplant patients aren't at risk, greater risk for all types of cancers, but you do increase your risk for some types of cancers after you get a transplant. Mostly has to do with the fact that your body on immunosuppressive meds is not able to screen for types of viruses and things that can trigger overgrowth of tissues and the development of cancers. We specifically worry a lot about skin cancers. Deborah mentioned being certain that you have regular dermatologic assessments and skin examinations, and that is so very important because although your risk is greatly increased, these are definitely things that can be addressed. A good dermatologist or plastic surgeon can monitor you on an ongoing basis and completely take care of this problem. You're at increased risk for lip and mouth cancers. Women are at greatly increased risk for cervical cancers, particularly if you have papillomavirus or herpes viruses. There's some increased risk for some types of blood and lymph node cancers, such as lymphoma or leukemia. Kidney transplant patients have an increased risk for renal cell carcinomas or kidney cancers. All of these are diseases that are completely curable with early recognition, and so it's very important that if you notice any lumps or bumps growing anywhere, that you let your doctor know about them early. Usually they're going to be nothing, but if they are something and they're found early, they can be addressed without any problem. Regular recommended screenings are so important, and Deborah mentioned having your pelvic and your pap smears, your regular lab work, all of those kinds of things can help prevent all of this. The second area under over-immunosuppression type side effects is the issue of infection. And actually, transplant patients, kidney transplant patients, don't really have more infections than dialysis patients do. They just tend to have different infections. So on dialysis, you tend to get peritonitis if you're doing TD, or you might get a vascular access infection or a line infection if you're doing hemodialysis. Those are usually bacterial infections. After transplant, the immunosuppressive medicines prevent your body's ability to screen and destroy funguses and viruses as well as it would if it were completely healthy. And so you're a little more risk for odd types of infections. The good news is that there are great drugs these days to treat those infections, and as long as they are recognized early, they generally can be completely cured. All of these types of complications are relatively rare, especially the cancers, but the infections as well. Immediately after transplant, at the time period where you are most intensely immunosuppressed, you'll actually be given medication to try and prevent any of these types of infections from occurring. And most patients are on an antiviral medication such as acyclovir or ganciclovir or valganciclovir, oftentimes on an antifungal drug such as fluconazole or nystatin. And these are being given to prevent the development of these types of infections. One caveat now, remember that even the medicines to prevent problems can have side effects. So the more medicines we give you, the more chances are that you'll have some other side effects. I want to move from talking about those extension of immunosuppression issues to talking a little bit about what I would refer to as true side effects. You'll remember I said these are going to be unique to each individual. And I tell my patients that I'm evaluating as potential transplant recipients, I give them the long list of medications and side effects that Deborah referred to she had gotten pre-transplant. And I always tell my patients, you're not going to get all of these, but I can guarantee you that you're going to get at least a few of them, because every patient I've ever had pretty much gets at least something, even if it's just weight gain. These, again, can sort of be thought of in categories of problems. I always start with talking about metabolic-type side effects, and the primary one of these is weight gain. The average weight gain in our patients here in Mississippi after kidney transplant is about 35 pounds. And some of our patients can stand to gain 35 pounds. Some are a little obese to start with, and that can be a real problem. We also see an increased risk for the development of diabetes. This is particularly an increased risk if you have a family history of diabetes. I tell my patients that required insulin or oral medications for diabetes before they get a transplant. With dialysis, sometimes you no longer need those medicines, but once you get a transplant, you almost certainly will require those medications again. You can do things to lower your risk for the development of diabetes, particularly around weight gain, diet, and exercise. We also see changes in cardiovascular issues as a side effect. Many patients will have high blood pressure. Some of them will develop high blood pressure after transplant that didn't have it beforehand, and it is likely a side effect of the medication. Deborah mentioned cholesterol, and several of the medications, especially the prednisone, can contribute significantly to an increase in your cholesterol and triglyceride levels. We actually reduce your risk for heart attack and stroke with a transplant over remaining on dialysis, but it's still important to treat both high blood pressure and cholesterol because the treatment will further lower your risk. Lots of patients have cosmetic side effects, and Deborah mentioned hair loss and actually hair growth. And that's relatively common. Usually, dose adjustment is going to be the thing that's going to help that the most. In some cases, we actually change from one type of immunosuppressive medicine to another to try and address that issue. If you're on cyclosporin or Neoral or one of the other cyclosporin formulations, you likely will see hair growth places you'd rather not have it. If you're on a tacrolimus or Prograf-based regimen, you're more likely to see hair loss. And actually changing from one of those to the other can sometimes fix that problem. Lots of patients have skin changes. Early on high doses of prednisone, many patients experience acne. I have patients tell me all the time, I feel like I'm a 15-year-old adolescent again. But that usually gets much better as we reduce the level of the dosage of the medication. Many patients get chipmunk cheeks. Again, very much dose-related, it usually gets better. Bone and joint diseases are very common, partly as side effects of your medications. It is very important that people exercise regularly and take good care of their joints. There's an increased risk for gout. Certainly patients who've had gout before they developed end-stage organ disease and required a transplant are more likely to experience more problems with that afterwards. Again, there are good medicines that can help control that. Sometimes dietary changes can assist as well. Gastrointestinal problems are very common after transplant related to the medication. I would say diarrhea and abdominal cramping after weight gain are probably my most common side effects that I see in our patients. Again, usually these are things that are not related to an infectious process, but actually to the medicines themselves, and by adjusting them, we can make all of that better. Many patients experience psychological and quality of life side effects. A lot of it's just anxiety. People are excited about their transplant. They want it to work. They are very committed to taking excellent care of themselves and their organ, and they worry constantly about if they are exposed to something bad or if they drink some alcohol or whatever, is this going to hurt their kidney? And it's important to talk to your healthcare professionals about that. The whole purpose of getting a transplant is to live as normal a life as possible. And yes, you want to take good care of yourself, but you want to have an active, busy life, and you want to not be overcome by anxiety or worry. I do have patients that have insomnia that's directly related to the medication sometimes, and again, adjusting dosages can make a huge difference with that. Sexual dysfunction is not uncommon after transplant, although I'll tell you with kidney transplant patients, I usually have less erectile dysfunction after transplant, less problems with that than on dialysis. I sometimes have spouses complain about increased activity. Again, if that's a problem, that is something that almost always your physician can help you address. There are lots of other side effects that I'm not talking about in detail because they're somewhat less common, but anything that you experience that is impacting your ability to live an active, healthy life the way you want to is something you ought to talk to your doc about. I want to spend a couple minutes talking in a little bit more detail about the weight gain because I feel very strongly that this is something that we can really empower our patients to get under control and take care of themselves. Prednisone definitely stimulates appetite, and for dialysis patients especially, you are going to be a lot hungrier after your transplant. Food is going to taste a lot better to you, which makes you want to eat even more of it. And you're going to have reduced dietary restrictions. So patients who have been so careful not to eat cheese or milk or to drink extra fluids, all of a sudden you can eat those foods. Oftentimes we're encouraging you to eat extra of those foods. Unfortunately, many of them have high calories. So it's critically important that you work closely with a dietitian and with your doc and other healthcare professionals to get on a good diet that's going to be heart healthy and it's going to control your weight from the outset. Oftentimes patients coming to transplant, not just kidney but heart and liver and lung transplants as well, will have deconditioned muscles from their chronic end-stage organ disease, and so it's very hard for them to exercise as actively as they might like. It's very important after the transplant to get back slowly but steadily into good exercise habits and moving around. Pre-transplant preparation with good exercise and eating habits will really help you as you get to transplant and post-transplant in trying to prevent weight gain. The other thing about weight gain is that it impacts so much many other side effects. If you don't gain a lot of weight, you're going to be less likely to get diabetes, you're going to be less likely to have joint problems, you'll actually even have fewer GI problems if you don't gain a lot of weight. So I encourage people to be very aware of this potential and to work hard up front at trying to prevent the development of a lot of extra body fat. In closing, I want to talk a little bit about coping with your side effects. And I want to just tell you again, if the single thing you take home from my chat with you today is to talk to your healthcare professionals, that'd be the most important thing. So often we can change your dosage schedule around or maybe the amount of the medicines you're taking, or potentially even switch you completely to a different type of medicine, and it'll make all the difference in the world. If your life is being compromised by your side effects, please talk to somebody. A lot of times lifestyle changes can help, exercising, dieting, getting busy. If you're anxious and depressed, getting focused on other folks and volunteering, getting involved with other transplant patients, other activities in your community can really help. Sometimes physical therapy can make a difference. Counseling can make a difference. Again, just talking with other folks, including other recipients, can help you cope with whatever experience, whatever kinds of problems you're experiencing. And as a last resort, sometimes we have to give you more pills to help with the problems you're having from the pills you're on. And I hate to say that, but a lot of times the medication, a new medication, can make a difference. I'll tell you that as I work with my patients, I always try to let that be the last resort because I do realize that it can be pretty unpleasant to take as many medications as many of our patients have to do. So finally, take-home messages. No one gets all the side effects, but almost everyone is going to get some side effects. I'll tell you that all my patients say the side effects are still worth the transplant. I have never had a patient that I have taken care of that has ultimately lost their transplant and gone back on dialysis that as they're losing function or once they're back on dialysis, one of the first questions they ask me is, Doc, when can I get on the list to get another transplant? Or, Doc, I have a wife or a friend or a family member that wants to give me a transplant. Can I get another one? And that's even the people who've had the worst side effects. So I'm convinced that the transplant is always worth it. And finally, don't ever suffer in silence. We can help, but you've got to tell someone. Thank y'all for the opportunity to talk.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schlesinger. And the last point just reminds me of a recipient that told us he suffered in silence for a long time with gout because he couldn't figure, it never occurred to him that gout in the feet could be related to kidneys in the stomach area. But from your message points and from Deborah's before talk, mention it, you can manage it. And now, with great pleasure, I'm going to introduce you to Dean Collier, our final speaker, who's a clinical pharmacist at the University of Nebraska Liver and Intestinal Transplant Program. Dean is the pharmacy editor of Transplant Chronicles, and this issue that was just released actually yesterday and is still coming out today has two articles on this topic about side effects, one written by a physician and one written by a recipient. And if you're not signed up to get it, do contact me and I'll sign you up. Now, I'm particularly happy that Dean could join us today because he's been very busy volunteering with a medical mission, going to other countries with doctors and nurses to help people less fortunate, and a job dear to NKF's heart since he's been volunteering at the Special Olympics. NKF is gearing up to have the U.S. Transplant Games, Olympic-style events in Pittsburgh starting in less than a month. And I think that many of our attendees at today's conference know about it, but for further information, you can contact me later. Without further ado, with great pleasure, I give you Dean.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by sharing with everyone parts of a letter I received from a transplant recipient. This letter was sent to me in response to a survey of transplant recipients that a colleague and I had developed. We designed this anonymous survey to gather information that would help pharmacists and other healthcare providers better understand medication self-management needs of transplant recipients. If we, your healthcare providers, better understand the concerns and the struggles of day-to-day life for the transplant recipient, we might be more able to help. Our thought was to improve existing programs or design new programs that would assist with self-management of immune suppression. To get to this information, we included in the survey a number of questions that were centered on taking immune suppressive medicines. The questions had been previously used by another researcher, Dr. Marie Chisholm from the University of Georgia. Some examples of the questions are, I have to take the immune suppressant medications too many times per day. And then the survey responder would answer, I strongly agree, I agree, or have no opinion, disagree, etc. Another question, I have to take too many capsules of my immune suppressant medications. I do not understand when to take my immune suppressant medications. I miss a dose of my immune suppressant medication when I think there may be side effects. back to the letter. After the survey had gone out, one recipient wrote back and was really very offended by the content of the survey. And I'll quote from the letter that was written. Evidently, there must be enough transplant patients out there who are not taking their medications as prescribed. These individuals should not have been given the opportunity to have a transplant, a second chance at life. Do you get it? Compared to spending 3 days a week on dialysis, taking a few pills every day is nothing. There was obviously some very strong emotion in this letter. I imagine the message, if not the sentiment, is one that many of our transplant recipients have heard, or at least thought they may have heard from doctors or pharmacists or perhaps their peers and friends. Shame on you for not taking your medicine, right? As a younger pharmacist working with transplant recipients, I was probably equally as naive of the challenge of taking immune suppressive medicines as many of you may be now. I thought, after such a transformation in health, how could anyone not take their medicines? As a more mature pharmacist, I've learned that very few people easily choose not to take their medicines. Rather, living well on immune suppressive medications is a constant struggle. I was reminded of this again while reading a soon-to-be-published booklet that was written by a group of transplant recipients. And I encourage all of you to read this booklet when it becomes available. It's entitled Living Well on Immune Suppressive Medications, and it'll be out later in July. I think my take-home message is, let's all move past the blaming and shame and try to truly understand what a tremendous effort it is to take so many medications after transplantation. Let's recognize this effort as one of the hardest parts about transplantation, and let's work together to find ways to overcome the problems. Anyone who takes medications on a continual basis will inevitably miss doses. The more medications one takes, the more challenging it becomes to be perfect. Recall the medication-related problems that you've just heard about from Deborah and Dr. Schlesinger. Yet for the best results, perfection in taking those medications should still be our target. If you're a transplant recipient, you don't have to do this alone. And you heard that from Dr. Schlesinger, and I'll reinforce it. You are part of a team. A very key part of any team is working together. As a pharmacist, I want your help in managing your immune suppressive medications. I need your help. I know the technical stuff. I went to school for a lot of years to learn those things. I know the usual doses of these medicines. I know the usual desired effects, and I know the usual unwanted effects that are possible for each one of these medicines. But without good, objective, and specific communication from you, the patient, I'm less able to provide the best care possible for you. If I don't know what hurts, if I don't know what aches, I can't help you. I can't make the changes that might help you. Because of this, I'll echo what Dr. Schlesinger said. I want to encourage all of you to find your voice. Communicate with the team your experiences with the medications that you are taking. As I said, taking so many medications is definitely one of the hardest parts about having a transplant. To do this well, to be successful, we need to work as a team. Thank you very much for listening. And I think, Kathy, we'll take any questions now.
We sure will. And before I ask the operator to tell you how to do so, I'm going to mention the booklet that Dean referred to is an NKF publication that will be available by calling NKF's information specialist, 800-622-9010, 800-622-9010, later this month, or I should say next month in July. And this booklet was written by recipients such as yourself, people that answered surveys that we sent out to them with input from professionals. And now, operator, will you open the floor and give instructions for questions?
Certainly. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you do have a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, press star 2. One moment, please, for the first question. First question comes from Mary Medina. Your line is open.
Yes, I was needing the website repeated for the slides that you're going to have available later this afternoon.
www.transplantrecipients.org. That's the transaction website. That's all one word, transplantrecipients.org.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Sarah Eads. Your line is open.
Yes. I'm a kidney transplant recipient, and I was diagnosed about 2 years ago with MAI. Do I need to tell you what that stands for, Mycobacterium avium intracellulare? And I have been seen a couple of times at National Jewish. I don't have any symptoms, and they have not yet started medication for the obvious reasons. Particularly with the pharmacist, maybe he can help me with this. Have you all ever seen or heard of a kidney transplant patient having MAI? How unusual is it? And what would you say is the best approach to this since I don't have any symptoms whatsoever?
I'm going to actually defer to Dr. Schlesinger. It's Mycobacterium is an opportunistic infection, and as Dr. Schlesinger kind of talked about, because of immune suppressive medicines, you're a bit of a setup for some of these kinds of infections. Dr. Schlesinger, do you have other thoughts?
Yeah, that would be down there in my category of rare. I actually have two patients in the last 15 or 20 years that I've taken care of that have had MAI or an atypical mycobacterium infection. One of those we actually never treated with anything. Sounded kind of like you didn't really have any symptoms. It was initially diagnosed on a bronchoscopy. It appeared to be at a time when they had another infection as well. When that infection was treated, all the symptoms resolved, and so we never treated the mycobacterium. My other patient has actually had some problems with lymphadenopathy, some growth of the lymph nodes in their neck, and we treated them with an antibiotic to treat the mycobacterium for probably about 3 months, and the symptoms completely resolved. But that patient is now about 4 years out from that, and we continue to maintain them on a Monday-Friday schedule of prophylactic antibiotics to try and prevent regrowth of their nodes. And he's doing fine with no problems. It's really rare. My suspicion is that if you're not having any problems from it right now, you probably won't, unless potentially at some point in the future you ended up getting another transplant and got heavy dose immunosuppressive drugs to start with again. And then you might have some more problems and need it treated. It tends to be treatable in transplant patients when there are side effects.
All right.
Sarah, okay. Dr. Schlesinger, may I add one more thing?
Yes.
Sarah, good for you for asking the question. I think that is a very important point of what we were talking about today, asking these questions where you're not clear about how things should be going for you. So one other question that I might have is you have the infection, or your doctors have told you you have the infection. They've decided not to treat it right now. Asking your doctors what kinds of things you should look for where it might be a problem or it might need to be treated, as Dr. Schlesinger mentioned, maybe with a retransplant or maybe with a rejection episode and more immune suppression is needed.
Right.
What things should you look for to recognize that the infection is becoming worse?
Well, I mean, my test results are all super. I mean, my creatinine is 0.8, 0.7. I don't have any kidney problems, but what they're saying to me is my PFT function is decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't notice it. I'm not coughing. I have no outward symptoms. I have plenty of energy. You know, it's just like if I hadn't gone in because I had another problem, which I was throwing up and had diarrhea, and I went in for that, and I said my side's bothering me a little bit, and before I got the kidney transplant, I had a pulmonary embolism in 92, long before my transplant, and they just did a simple, test. I don't know if it was a sonogram or whatever they did, and they said, you have COPD, and my internal medicine guy said, it ain't COPD, I don't know what it is, and it turned out after they did some more tests and lavage, it turned out they diagnosed this NAI, which I had never even heard of, and nobody had ever warned me anything about that, so it's a real problem. I mean, I don't know what to do about it, and they're putting it back in my lap, you know. I'm not the doctor. I don't know what to do, so.
Yeah, well, the things you want to do is inform yourself, I think. Asking the questions of what should I look for. If it is coughing, increased coughing, then when should I tell you, when should I inform you, the physicians? When do they want you to talk to them about increased coughing? If it's increased shortness of breath, or maybe it will be more regular chest x-rays, or
they're doing CTs twice, sometimes three times a year, and even that's very dangerous. See, then I'm because I don't want lung cancer, obviously, from too many CTs. So I don't know. It's just a real problem. But I appreciate you guys addressing it and trying to answer it. I don't know where I'm going to find the answer.
Before we move on to the next question, reporting your symptoms accurately so they get attention is very important too. So many times, and what Dean brought up made me think of this, but sometimes you go into a doctor and you put your best foot forward and say, oh, I'm feeling a little of this or a little of that. But to really let them know how often the symptoms occur, the severity, how it's affecting your life, and details, and describing it accurately is very important. And asking the questions Dean said can help too. So thank you, and
thank you all very much. It was a great conference. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Maury Furrier. Your line's open.
Hi, I'd like to see if someone would address the what's going on in research or in practical practice with the chronic rejection issue, the Achilles heel of transplantation, if you will, and as someone who had a zero match cadaveric kidney for 22 years, and a year and a half ago it went kaput, I'd like to hear what's going on.
Well, tolerance continues to be, as you mentioned, the elusive holy grail of transplantation. There's a lot of work still being done looking at new medicines. There are some new things in the pipeline. We're talking about trying to come up with things that are a once every 3 months subcutaneous injection so that issues about missing the occasional medicine, no matter how hard you try not to, we eliminate that piece of things. Now, I always tell my patients that God gave us a remarkable immune system. It's a defense against all proteins foreign. And really short of an identical twin, any allograft, any transplanted organ that you receive has some proteins at the molecular level that are foreign. And thus far, we have yet to find the perfect balance or the perfect drug or intervention that can only address the foreign proteins of the transplant without impacting our body's ability to scan for the infections and the malignancies and those sorts of things. I will say we're making progress. I would be very surprised if we achieve the ability to provide a global tolerance for all individuals that need transplants any time in my lifetime. I do think that we're seeing longer graft survival times, and we have new tools in our armamentarium from a medication standpoint, but we've got a ways to go. And, of course, we also are looking in terms of the organ shortage in trying to engineer some type of xenograft, a pig heart or kidney or whatever, just to reduce the organ shortage issues. And there we have even harder immunologic barriers to overcome. So it's a tough question. Right now we're still looking at new medications, new molecular type drugs that can make a difference.
Maureen,
thank you
for that difficult but excellent question.
Our next question comes from Patricia Pavin. Your line is open.
Great. Hi. My question's about energy and fatigue. I'm 6 years post-transplant, liver transplant, and I'm so tired. I have energy one day, and then I don't the next, and it's a fatigue. And I'm wondering if taking something that boosts our immune system would be okay for us, something like the Monavie juice that has the acai berry, or possibly taking something or doing something that cleanses our immune system. Is
Dean, do you want to say a few words, and then I'll speak to that. I'll tell you what I tell my patients about those things.
I'm not familiar with the Monavie juice or the acai berry. I think in general, if you're taking something that boosts your immune system, you're tipping a balance that has been achieved over the 6 years that you've had your liver transplant, and you may not be tipping the balance in a positive way. It's possible you could trigger a rejection episode or trigger the need for more immune suppressive medicines by changing that balance. Over-the-counter medicines and herbal medicines, I would ask your pharmacist, I would do some good research on those medicines, and take an approach that your doctors take, and that is first do no harm. If there is no real harm in those medicines, then try them, see if it helps you with the energy. Let your doctors and pharmacists know that you have made a choice to try these medicines, and follow the outcomes very objectively. So you said you have energy one day, you don't have the next day. What are your expectations in taking the Monavie juice? How much more energy do you think it will give you, or what would you want it to give you? Completely eliminate any signs of being tired, or maybe 2 days you feel good for every one day that you do have fatigue, and that's acceptable. So the kinds of things Kathy talked about, being very objective about what your symptoms are and what is improvement to you, I think are very important.
Mm-hmm. I usually ask my patients to bring me in the labels from any sorts of health food or energy stimulants or memory stimulants or those sorts of things that they are considering taking to let me look at them. And there are some things like St. John's wort and ginkgo biloba, or however you say that word, and ginseng and those sorts of things that are advertised as immune stimulants, but there are at least anecdotal reports in the transplant literature have been associated with rejection of organs. And so I look carefully at labels and try to eliminate anything that has any of those ingredients in it. On the flip side is a lot of the sort of energy type supplements that are out there are mostly about protein and vitamin sorts of concoctions, mm-hmm. and often those are going to be fine for my patients to take.
Right.
I really do encourage people to talk to, I have lots of patients that I have join the YMCA or do things like that, and work with a personal trainer to look at issues regarding things like how are you sleeping? How are you eating? What kind of exercise are you getting? Because oftentimes we have behavioral habits that may be impacting our energy level or our fatigue status that we're just not even paying attention to. maybe some nights you're not getting as good of sleep, or there may be some foods that you're eating that are making you more tired. There may be some different types of exercises that you know, maybe you're trying to walk or jog and you really need to be in a pool as opposed to on asphalt or something like that. And so a lot of times by just getting some of those things looked at. The other thing that's important is that your physician also needs to look at things like thyroid function. Could you be hypothyroid? Could there be a medical reason? Are your phosphorus levels low? So it's really important to mention it to your doc so that they can make certain that there's not some other physiologic issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, that sounds good. They've already checked my thyroid. I don't know about the phosphorus levels. Does that go with the thyroid?
No, and in liver transplant patients, it's usually not so much a problem. In kidney transplant patients, oftentimes they'll have phosphorus and magnesium mm-hmm. wasting issues after transplant, and if those minerals are low, then your muscle strength is reduced, and it'll make you tired.
Okay. I've already asked. I keep asking questions. I do have a very good liver doctor. But sometimes I think doctors settle into the idea, well, it's your age.
Well,
and I really dislike that.
I will say this, we all get a little tired as we get older.
Right.
But you should still be able to be fairly consistently active.
Okay.
And I'd keep looking for answers.
Yes, because I'm not consistently active, and that's one thing that it's impacted my life. That's the biggest impact. But I do appreciate your answers. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that excellent question.
Our next question comes from Scalene Leslie. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm a sister of a transplant patient, and I'm taking care of him as much as I can. And I have two questions. The first one is, he was vision impaired due to his kidney issues before he received the transplant. And he only has one eye anymore because he did have an experimental procedure and it went bad. So he has one eye and that isn't doing well. And now that he's been on the immune suppressant drugs, that vision is going as well. I understand that could be an issue from the medications he's on. And I'm wondering, number one, if this will go away eventually or is he eventually going to be completely blind? He has to take the immune suppressant, so that's not an option. Have you noticed that there are patients that are losing their vision because of the immune suppressants?
Is he diabetic?
No.
He's not diabetic.
No, he was, though, before he had
the transplant.
In fact,
before the kidney disease.
Right. He had gained a lot of weight, and then he lost it, and then he was no longer an active diabetic. And then he went on dialysis about a year later, and then he had a transplant.
And how long out now is he from transplant?
About 6 months.
I will tell you that oftentimes I have patients whose vision gets worse acutely after transplant related to poor glucose control, the return of the development of a diabetic milieu, so to speak. Many of those patients will get improvement again in their vision, and then we'll have some stabilization, but not all. And it does depend to a large extent on what the underlying retinal issue is, if it's a macular degeneration versus a traditional diabetic retinopathy versus some completely other issue. It is very important that he be seeing an ophthalmologist regularly, because you also can have opportunistic eye infections such as cytomegalovirus or something like that, which could be acutely treated and resolved.
Okay.
So although we often assume with someone who's been diabetic before transplant and then has sugar disruption again after transplant, we'll often assume, well, it's the steroids and the sugar being out of control and it's going to get better when we get that under control. It is important to have a full ophthalmologic exam and make certain that there's not something else superimposed. You also can develop glaucoma and pressure changes post-transplant, sometimes with these medications, and again, that's very treatable. So if he's not seen an ophthalmologist since transplant, he needs to see one relatively urgently to make certain that if there are any other sorts of interventions that need to be done, they're done. I would give you some hope, though, that I have a fair number of patients who do have some acute changes in their vision in that first, although usually by 6 months it's beginning to get better again.
Okay, well, that's good, because he was under, you know, he's been seeing an ophthalmologist, although he hasn't seen one since his transplant.
He needs to see someone post-transplant.
Yeah.
Okay, And then the other question I had was, he is coming to visit me. He lives in California, and he's coming to Nevada for 2 months. He's a teacher, and he's off, so I'm going to be able to watch him better. And would that be an issue for his immune system to go from California to Nevada?
I like my patients to travel.
Oh, okay.
As long as they take their medicines with them and take them regularly, I think it's great.
Okay.
Any comments or Deborah comments about that?
Oh, I definitely have comments, because the National Kidney Foundation has been absolutely wonderful for me, and they've allowed me to travel to places I never thought I would see. You know, so
okay.
I think it would boost his spirit, you know, to be able to travel some, and you know, and of course, if he needs assistance on the plane, they will help him.
Oh well, I'm gonna drive and pick him up and bring him home.
I don't
want him on a plane, so he's coming back that way. And the last question I have is, what happens if you miss your medication by an hour?
Usually, an hour one way or the other is not gonna be a huge problem. Most of these medications, and Dean could address this more effectively than I do, but most of these medications have a half-life, or the amount of time that the drug is hanging around in their blood and in their tissues is much longer than when their next dose is going to be. So there's some overlap time, and an hour or two one way or the other is not going to make a difference. But I really encourage people to get in habits of when you're going to take the drug every day, just because when you're off a few hours one way or the other and you change your habits, it's much easier to miss it altogether.
Yes.
When you miss it altogether is when you start having problems. I tell my patients it's like having a shield around your kidney, and if you, it's only lasting for so many hours, and if you miss your next dose, the shield comes down, and then the cells that are responsible for causing scarring and destruction of the organ are able to get in past the shield and begin to destroy the kidney or the liver or the heart or whatever the organ is. Once you put the shield back up, you prevent more cells from getting in right then when you take your next dose of medicine, but you've already let some immune cells get in that can trigger the beginning of scarring and problems. And every time you miss your medicine, and it's not an hour late, it's missing a complete dose, you have the potential to take some time off how long that organ is going to last for you long term.
Okay, I agree with that 100%. He has missed it. He has a little timer on his cell phone, and it goes off at 7 o'clock in the morning and 7 o'clock at night. But once in a while, he's missed it by a half an hour, 45 minutes. So I was just curious. Well, I appreciate all your help, and I really enjoy the Kidney Foundation, because it's really helping me to learn how to take care of my brother, and that's very important to me. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Operator, how many more questions do we have on queue right now?
We have 13.
13. Panelists, can we stay and take a few more questions? Are you, should we take, so I'm thinking we can take 5 more questions and then have the rest of them email me.
Okay.
And I will answer them with the help of the panelists by email. Okay. Does that sound?
Yes, I'm available.
I'm good.
Okay. I'm good.
Okay. Let's do that then.
Okay. Our next question is from Mary Catherine Sears. Your line is open.
Hello. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you very, very much for a wonderfully informative calling session. I am active with the Kidney Foundation via our Michigan office, and am just very pleased to be a part of the Kidney Foundation. Looking forward to attending the transplant games beginning July 11th.
Thank you.
And I just had two quick things. I've been experiencing a number of antibiotics I've been having difficulty with that I could take before my transplant. And I have found that since the transplant, I am severely allergic and also have had an increase in my prograft level. So I guess my question may be for Dean Collier as far as working with immunosuppressives and different antibiotics.
What kind of problems are you having that you didn't have before?
One particular problem was with Augmentin,
mm-hmm.
which I could take before. But since the transplant, there is one chemical component of Augmentin that is reacting with the tacrolimus, apparently. That's what the pharmacist told me here in Saginaw. So that actually left me with just severe nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, uncontrolled.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was Levaquin, which elevates my prograft level. I actually thought I was going back into kidney failure. I mean, I just didn't feel right taking that medicine. And as soon as I called my kidney physician, he said, you know, what are you taking? And I said, Levaquin. And he said, oh, my God. He said he's just started to hear patients that are taking that it interferes with the tacrolimus level.
So you're taking more tacrolimus now, more prograft now than in the past?
Actually, I am taking less prograft now than in the past. I've had my kidney transplant 8 years, and Lucy, my kidney, and I are doing very well. But reactions with those two antibiotics were just so sudden, and, you know, I thought I was really on my way back into kidney failure, if not death. They were just very violent reactions.
Hmm. Drug interactions are always a concern with these medicines. The prograft is cleared from your body through the liver, and it uses a very popular set of enzymes in your liver. Many other drugs and substances use those same enzymes, so prograft ends up competing with other drugs, and levels can go up, levels can go down, and it's very important for the doctors and pharmacists to, anytime you're started on a new med, to make sure that it's going to be okay. I think for you, important to ask whenever a new medicine is prescribed, ask the question, will this interact with my prograft? Will this interact with my prednisone? You know, asking those questions, taking a more forward role for yourself and protecting yourself.
All righty, thank you.
And I would like to ask her, was it a nephrologist who prescribed these medications for you, or was it a different physician?
Actually, it was my family doctor, and the nephrologist caught it. So
okay, because before I'm prescribed any type of medication, and I guess that's the advantage of having all the physicians in one facility, if I go to a different physician other than my nephrologist, he will contact the nephrologist first to make sure that it's okay for me to take the medication, even before I had the colonoscopy. You know, they wanted to make sure that it was okay for me to take the PrEP.
Right, exactly. Well, the same with me. Is this Deborah?
Yes.
Yeah, Deborah, I'm a fellow LPN.
Okay. Michigan. Very good.
Yeah, and one of the things that really I struggled with after the transplant was returning to work.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
I found I couldn't do it. So at the present, you know, I was working actually a desk job, moving out of the hospital because of severe latex allergy. And then, doing a different line of work with my LPN, but I had to quit my job because I couldn't handle the steroids and the immunosuppressives, and things were really tough. So.
Oh, sure. And plus you have to be real careful about what type of patients that you're exposed to, you know, as a recipient.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I would reinforce that it's always important when anyone prescribes you new medications, check with your whoever is following you specifically for your transplant and monitoring your transplant medications to make sure there aren't going to be interactions. We use a lot of Levaquin and we use a lot of Augmentin and Amoxicillin and those medications in transplant patients. Mm-hmm. Some folks do have usually a rise in their tacrolimus levels when they're on Levaquin. It's usually relatively modest, and most patients don't require an alteration in their prograf dosages. I have also had patients who've developed an interstitial nephritis, which is a sort of allergic reaction in the kidney itself from Levaquin, and that can sometimes be a problem. It's important to remember that anybody can have an allergy to just about any medication, and so anytime you start a new medicine for anything, even if your nephrologist thinks it's okay and it's not going to interfere with your immunosuppressive medicines, you always want to pay attention to how you're feeling. And if you start feeling bad or noticing something strange within a few days of starting the medicine, you want to call your doc and let him know.
Right. And my kidney doctor and my internist have a very good relationship. I mean, they, you know, it's good between the two of them because they keep both informed, et cetera. Even with over-the-counter medications, anything, I'm always checking with that. So do I have time for one more quick question?
Go ahead.
Regarding sexual issues with women following transplant. And I found just almost a total, well, in addition to the diabetes, I understand there's issues there, but almost a total lack of interest in any sexual activity.
That would actually be one of those things that I would definitely look at medications regarding. I usually have my patients see an OBGYN and have hormonal levels checked. I would tell you that for both women and men, I tend to have people develop more interest as opposed to having a reduction in interest, although then oftentimes, not oftentimes, but not infrequently, my male patients, particularly those that are on a lot of antihypertensive medicines,
mm-hmm.
will have erectile dysfunction problems that we have to address. I do have female patients that have been placed on hormonal supplements by their OBGYN to address the issue of decreased interest, or in some cases, decreased genital responsiveness,
yes.
Lack of moisture, and those sorts of things. I occasionally will prescribe something, but I really don't have a lot of expertise in that. But the OBGYN docs are wonderful at dealing with that issue. So I have an early reflex to refer people to the OBGYN docs. I have more problems with patients getting pregnant unexpectedly, and I would really remind, and I remind all my female patients immediately post-transplant, if they've not had tubal ligations or whatever, and they are premenopausal, that fertility is often restored after transplant that may have been missing with end-stage renal disease on dialysis. And so it's really important that people take action with contraceptives post-transplant. But I just really encourage you to see your OBGYN and talk very frankly with them about the issue and ask them about possible treatment.
Good. Dr. Schlesinger, thank you so much. That was one area I hadn't even thought about, trying to CYN. So
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again, everybody, and God bless you for the work you do and for helping those of us that are journeying with transplants.
Thanks, Mary.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Roberta Monahan. Your line is open.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm on the West Coast. I had a question regarding pharmacy and, unfortunately, insurance. I am a double lung transplant, 7.5 years out, and I'm attending the transplant games, by the way.
Great.
But I am having a large problem. I have to take some medications because I live in the Northwest that aren't necessarily normal for a transplant, such as itraconazole, because we have such damp climate, fungal infections are seen more often here. And I have a lot of trouble with insurance wanting to pay for some of those because they don't fit into their transplant scheme. Do you have any suggestions or recommendations for dealing with insurance companies?
It's a challenge. Oftentimes, whenever a new medicine comes out or something, as you mentioned, is off the usual list, it can be very, very much a challenge with the insurance companies because they've got a list that they recognize as appropriate, and anything outside of that, they don't want to pay for. The best thing that you can do, and it may not work, but the best thing that you can do is have your doctors write letters, forward literature that supports the use of that medicine to the insurance company. And it may take more than one letter. It may take more than one time of forwarding information, but eventually we would hope to get the insurance company to recognize the need and recognize that a little bit of prophylaxis would be a lot better than a long hospital stay in the end should you get a fungal infection.
Right.
Those are my thoughts. Deb or Dr. Schlesinger, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, sometimes better not to have insurance. I've actually had several patients that have had to be on itraconazole or voriconazole chronically.
Which I am. I've been on it for 6 years. And every time we switch insurance,
you have to deal with it again.
Yes, again and again.
The companies that make those medications actually have compassionate need programs, and I have been, I have been fortunate in that my patients who have needed those medicines have not had insurance, have not had a lot of need. And we've ultimately been able to get the medicine through the companies at a markedly reduced price because of their more or less indigent status. I actually have more trouble with insurance companies. I would encourage you to work with a social worker at your transplant program who can help your physicians write letters to your insurance company. But Dina's exactly right. Usually what we have to do is make a case for paying for the medicines up front. We'll save them money on the back end.
Okay.
And your social worker usually is pretty good at putting those words together.
Well, my issue is I had a transplant. The transplant I had done, they don't do in the state I live in. I had to go to a different state, so my social worker and things like that were, well, they don't even work. I can't find them anymore. So because I'm so far out, let's just say my support system has fallen apart. Because I've been relatively healthy, I have a transplant doctor, and that's about all. I don't have anyone else. I'm not sure how to build that kind of system again because it's given to you when you have a transplant. But once you're, you know, after I was about 3 or 4 years out, it kind of, I didn't know who to go to anymore. So I'm having trouble with that as well.
Go ahead, Dr. Schlesinger. Even though you're a lung transplant patient, you may want to. There are more kidney transplant programs around than anything else. And
yes.
Oftentimes, I mean, the medications are very similar no matter what the transplant type of allograft is. You may want to actually just call whatever's your closest kidney transplant program and get a name and a number for the social worker at that program and give them a call. My experience with social workers is they tend to be wonderful human beings who are eager to help anyone who could use their services.
Okay.
It might be worth trying to establish a relationship with one of the kidney program social workers around these medication issues because they'll have some knowledge about what some ideas might be.
Right. And, I don't qualify for a lot of the special needs type of pain for, sure. because I have to work full time to, you know, keep a roof over my head.
Yeah, I know. It's often that our people who are working hard and having insurance sometimes are penalized by the system.
I feel that way oftentimes, yes.
Yeah, and one thing I like to add, you know, I don't know exactly what your financial situation is, and I know that the housing and the economy, we're in trouble right now, but I decided to stay in this area, in the D.C. area, because I only live 12 miles away from my physician. Of course, I would prefer to be in South Carolina because that's where my family is, but if I had gone there, then I was looking at a possibly 40-mile drive to a nephrologist. So, you know, like I said, this was certainly not the area that I was chosen, you know, to settle in, but I knew that I needed health care nearby.
Now, health care does tend to be geographic in terms of what insurance and state mm-hmm. programs offer. And the issues you brought up are very important ones, and I'm glad you brought them up. At www.transplantrecipients.org, under resources, this is the same area where now Dr. Schlesinger's PowerPoint is now posted. I just checked. It's under news and events. But under the resources, we do have some options and advice for people seeking help with drug costs. And even if you don't qualify for the charitable programs of the manufacturer of these drugs, these manufacturers also may have reimbursement help because they want their drugs paid for, the manufacturers. They want them used. They want them regarded as important, which, you know, they are and paid for. And often they can help you by even giving you literature or helping your doctor get the literature that can be faxed over to the insurance company. There's times where I've sat at the fax machine and just faxed professional journal articles from medical journals to insurance companies. Insurances do often reject claims first, and you have to be persevere. You have to persevere, and you have to be consistent. You can't take no for an answer. You have to work up the chain, talk to a supervisor, appeal, and often what they do is they're set up to discourage you.
Right.
But you need the drug or your doctor wouldn't prescribe it. They don't prescribe
right.
it for fun. So
right.
unfortunately, you have to use your best advocate skills to do that. And any of these type of questions, people sometimes do get lost. You can also email me and call me, and I'll try to find something for you, you know, work with you to do that.
And again, the other, because I work full-time, all of these places are only open Monday to Friday. You can't exactly take time off work to try to get your drugs paid for because then you can't pay for your drugs. So I find it's a vicious circle that you, because I'm so healthy, I now pay for being healthy. So, but anyway, I appreciate your assistance. Thank you.
Please do call me after the call. I'll give my number and name.
Okay.
And contact.
Okay. That would be helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Oliver Hale. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone.
Hi,
hello,
Oliver.
Hi, Oliver.
I want to commend Kathy and NKF for putting together this beautiful group. I commend each one of you for what you're doing and your effort in the world of kidney recipients. I am a 25-year kidney patient. I just recently had a kidney reject after almost 23 years. And my problem was about 3 years ago, I changed jobs and, you know, with the insurance stuff, COBRA, and then the COBRA ran out. And I couldn't afford to pay my cyclosporine. And what happened, they put me on a different cyclosporine, which was a generic. And from that point, my creatinine started rising from the 0.9 to 3, then went to 5, and, of course, hit 8. And then now I'm back rejected, back on dialysis after 3 years. I want to ask the whole panel, is there anything, any of you, Kathy, is there anything out there that can probably help someone in my situation? You know, I just got back from Washington. I was there on the cyclosporine beer and the kidney care beer while I was doing some lobbying. But is there anything out there that someone can go to when they see that they're going to have financial problems, a long-term transplant recipient, and they sure don't want to go back on dialysis. Is there anything out there that can help them?
I want to start this off, and he did address it to the whole panel. It's really a terrible story for us to hear. First, take action. It's very good that you're doing this legislative advocacy work on Capitol Hill. And if others want to get involved, if you go to www.kidney.org/take-action, you can hear about the legislation and the bills. One of the things we're trying to do is increase the coverage of Medicare for immunosuppressive drugs at 80% for the life of the organ rather than stop with kidney transplant recipients after 3 years. Oliver, for the drug Neoral from Novartis, they have a number of manufacturer assistance programs, some of which are the best I've ever heard of in terms of getting a coupon that you can take to a pharmacy and get filled immediately for like an emergency 30-day supply to help while you figure out the next steps. And in 1998, the NKF did a program about generics versus brand name drugs and how switching from one to the another is very serious business that has to be done under direction of your physician to make sure that things go well and that you don't suffer for it the way that you did. That being said, to reiterate what Dr. Schlesinger just said, talk to the transplant social worker first to try to find your way through this. The manufacturers of drugs often have programs to help you find your way through this. The local NKF offices, the national office through me, your contact, and our website has a number of options, including a book that we have, Taking Control, Money Matters for People with Kidney Disease, which goes through the whole gamut of possibilities of things that might help you. It's very complicated in this country because there's no national system, and depending where you live, there may be different options available also based on your income and your situation, etc.
Thank you. Kathy?
Yes.
Also, I just want to say I am going to a transplant game, but I'm not going as an athlete. As you know, I have been to every transplant game since the NKF has started, since 1990, and then I have been to two previous international games in 87 in Innsbruck and 89 in Singapore. So I have had a good year life of my endurance. I'm looking forward to get another one. Hopefully I can and get back to where I was.
I'm glad you brought that up. The NKF is also coming out with an article for Transplant Chronicles and probably some other programs about if your transplant fails, you know, how best to take care of yourself while you're waiting for another transplant or while you're preparing for another transplant. Thank you, Oliver, and let me ask the rest of the panelists if they have something further.
Our next question comes from Roger McDonald. Your line is open.
Thank you. Oliver, I just heard from Nancy Swick last week, and she told me you were back on dialysis. I was sorry to hear about that. Oliver and I have been buku transplant games, and my main purpose is to mention to several other people that the transplant games are an excellent place to interact with other people of all different kind of transplanting, discuss medicines, etc. In my own case, I think I'm the only person that competes in the transplant games who is a donor and a recipient. I donated a kidney to my brother in 1972, and then in the mid-90s, my kidney went bad, and I had 10 great years of transplant games. Oliver said he went to two international games. I've been to Japan and Australia and France and just had a wonderful time. However, about 2 years ago, everything started falling apart. I had a little cancer that you guys mentioned, that cancer is a risk. I've had gout off and on. I've had a lot of joint problems. I recently had knee surgery, which didn't do well. And so I wanted to ask about some of the, I've heard of a thing called, I think it's ketoprofen. And my orthopedic guy said I should try it, but the nephrologist never would give me the go-ahead. Our orthopedic guy's thought was that the ketoprofen, if that's how you pronounce it, wouldn't get into the bloodstream. It would just get in the knee. Does anybody know anything about that?
Is this an injection, Roger?
No, it's an oral.
I think it's in the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory.
Yeah, it is. And the problem with that, Roger, is that if you're still taking tacrolimus or cyclosporin, tacrolimus and cyclosporin can, one of their unwanted effects is limiting the amount of blood flow or changing the blood flow through your kidney.
Mm-hmm.
The non-steroidals change that blood flow as well. And so you end up with even less blood flow into the kidneys, and then you end up with an injury to the kidney because of lack of blood flow, and it can be very, very serious. We've only used the non-steroidals that I can think of in 15 years in maybe one patient, and it was under a really very controlled circumstance where their joint pain was so bad that nothing else was working, not Tylenol, not steroids, and we were forced to use that. But in the end, it really didn't work either because the serum creatinine started to go up. So they're not really compatible with a kidney transplant.
Right. Okay, well, sorry to hear that, but I'm glad you told me. The last question, is Gengraft, is that considered a generic?
Yes, it's a generic form of Neoral.
Yeah. Is it? I've been on it for a couple, 3 years now. I don't seem to have any problems with it.
Most people will tolerate the generics fine. It's just that the levels need to be monitored when you change from the brands to the generics, because some patients will metabolize them somewhat differently and will need a dosage adjustment in that change, which is why it's so important that it not happen without your physician's knowledge.
Thanks. Okay, well, thanks very much, and I appreciate this. This has been an interesting session.
Along that line, when you get your drugs from the pharmacist, look at them carefully to make sure that they look like the drugs you're supposed to have.
Good point. Yeah. And don't be afraid to ask a question. This doesn't look like the medicine I got last month. Can you tell me why?
Right.
I did that.
Good for you.
Good for you. I think we're going to have to wrap up now. What I'd like to do is encourage you to either call me or email me with the questions that we didn't get to. And I'll work with the crew, the panelists, to answer your questions on an individual basis. I can't thank our panelists enough, I can't thank our audience and participants enough, and I can't thank our sponsor enough. We thank Novartis Pharmaceuticals for providing the educational grant to make the booklet that Dean talked about and today's telephone forum possible. Now, you can contact me at 800-622-9010, extension 144, 800-622-9010, extension 144, or email me at Kathy, C-A-T-H-Y, P as in Peter, at kidney.org. And good morning and good afternoon, depending where you are in the country. And I'm just so glad you joined us today. Thank you. Oh, I do have one more thing to say, is that this recording will be available on MP3 on our website. It'll be right next to Dr. Shirley Schlesinger's PowerPoint on the news and events, and it'll be available 24/7 for the next 30 days until July 18th by calling a toll-free number and listening to it, 866-434-5271. 866-434-5271. 4271. That number is on the flyer that you received about this call. Thank you so much again.
Okay. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.